This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
If ever I was going to make that shruggy emoji work on the radio, today would be the day. Jobs, tariffs, stocks, what is going on? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, April the 6th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, I wasn't kidding about that shruggy emoji thing, right? There's like a half a dozen places we could start today, any and or all of which are big deals for this economy. However, since we've only got 5 minutes in which to wrap things up this week, we are going to go big picture, all trade and tariffs all the time. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
So, Lynette, I made a big deal earlier this week about saying, you know what, we can't really call it a trade war yet because the sanctions haven't actually gone into effect. Given now that we are in this quid pro quo stage of this thing, can you say trade war?
I think that people would prefer that we say posturing. What is certain is that we are in a world of deal-based trade instead of rules-based trade, which is what people in the world of trade are calling it. But we're being helmed in this country by a man who kind of bankrupted several casinos. So it's unclear if the deals are going to be up to par we need.
Yeah, no, Sudeep, pick up on that, would you? The deals-based phase of international trade and economics. How much of this $100 billion set of new tariffs that the president announced last night, how much of that is him setting himself up to have a negotiating position?
Look, the president of the United States is a real estate guy. He operates in a certain framework that involves negotiating, trying to up the ante, trying to create a good negotiating position. He thinks he can bring that kind of framework to the two largest economies in the world and see if they could, chest thump each other on the way to a deal. And that's exactly what they're doing. There's a lot of chest beating going on here to see whether anybody might back off. Eventually, it could come together as a nice little summit where they hash out all these differences and both sides can claim that they've come up with some gains for their countries. But it doesn't look like it's going in that direction right now.
Okay, but wait, because I hear you on the whole negotiating thing and all of that. But Lynette, you look at the stock market, right, and traders saying, what is going on? You look at the hog farmers we've been talking to and the apple farmers, and they're all like, what are they doing? Do you suppose anybody in the White House understands the concept of economic uncertainty?
I think they do. I think they just don't care. Peter Navarro has gone on television several times.
The head of the Trade Council for the president, yeah.
Yes, and been quite flippant about people's concerns. Wilbur Ross has been pretty flippant about them, too. They're like, why are you guys overreacting?
Yeah.
But it seems like the Trump administration has no reason to back down until the 2018 elections. And the Chinese government has shown a willingness to marshal all of its resources to help ailing companies and ailing industries when they're in the face of danger. So because they have that power as a as an authoritarian regime, they can hold out for short to medium terms as well.
Right.
So that's something you have to think about.
And they are being very strategic politically, Sudeep, in how they target these sanctions. You overlay the map of the sanctions with areas of Trump supporters, and it's a pretty good match.
They can read a map. Yes, they can. They know exactly where they can twist the knife to try to force Trump's hand and to force the hands of members of Congress who are going into an election in a few months where all of this stuff is supposed to be on the line. And the Chinese know where to exert levers as well. And they have lots of other tools. They're flying sanctions back and forth. They can start dealing with regulations. They could mess with markets. There are a lot of things that you could see this go down. So we're certainly facing the prospect of a multi-front war if this thing keeps going on.
Lynette, I want you to play the other side of the coin for me on this one. The president, in a lot of ways, is right. The Chinese do force technology transfer, right? They do steal intellectual property. So what's wrong with getting tough with them after decades of this kind of behavior from the Chinese?
Well, I've talked to a lot of experts about this, and they say what we really need to do is have a coordinated effort with our allies in the EU so that the Chinese don't have any choice or any options but to stop with these joint ventures, stop with technology transfers, because the entire world is unified against that behavior. Now, this is not the approach we're taking. We're taking an approach where Donald Trump is going at this alone, where he's saying to the farmers who might be affected by Chinese tariffs, I will give you subsidies, which in turn will make our allies even more angry because mm-hmm. they'll say, hey, what about our subsidies? And then the legality of that, not that this regime cares about the legality of trade measures. Obviously, they've shown that they don't care. But that legality mm-hmm. of it aside, our own allies and our friends might then give subsidies to their own farmers. And then we're messing with the supply demand the natural supply and demand of any commodity or whatever good we're talking about. And that will make price wonky, and you're going to see all the weird things that we've been seeing in the market.
Right.
The market is just pricing all these possibilities in right now. And the fact that it's like a computer that has too many algorithms to think about. It's starting to fritz.
Lynette Lopez at Business Insider, Sidi Breddy at Politico, talking tariffs and trade and all that good stuff. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
Thanks.
All right. Have a nice weekend. We are going to talk about this morning's jobs report in a minute. But suffice it to say, you take a distinctly meh report on unemployment like the one we got this morning, throw in an abundance of will there or won't be a trade war uncertainty, as we were just talking about, and traders on Wall Street threw in the towel right from the open. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so the jobs report this morning was underwhelming. 103,000 new jobs added to the economy in March, well below expectations. Part of that, of course, was weather, a super harsh March after an unusually mild February. And really, you average it all out, we're still adding about 200,000 jobs a month this year, which is good. Except for this, you might call it the ghost of jobs reports to come, because this run of economic growth that we are having, well, it's getting very long in the tooth, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Job growth in March, economists pretty much agreed it was mediocre, soft, meh. But then economist Rob Hayworth at U.S. Bank told me this.
In general, we think this is consistent with where we are in the economic cycle, which is we're pretty late in the economic cycle. We have a pretty mature jobs market at this point.
The economic expansion is now one of the longest since World War II. We're at or near what economists call full employment, with so few people still looking for work that labor shortages develop and employers have to hike wages aggressively to attract workers. Economist Joseph Bruzuelas at consulting firm RSM.
The labor market has been tight. Over the next 10 years, there's going to be a shortage of around 8.5 million workers, primarily due to the demographic transition we're going through as the baby boom retires.
And what does that mean in terms of future job growth?
About 80,000 jobs a month to keep the unemployment rate stable.
Which will look pretty lousy compared to the job growth we've seen for the past few years. But would it be a sign of bad times to come? Dan North at Euler Hermes, a provider of business insurance, says not at all. He visits companies all over the country.
Business conditions are just terrific. Demand is through the roof. The problem that employers are facing, it's that they can't find employees.
At least employees with the skills they want at the wages they want to pay to contribute to the bottom line. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The Trump administration kicked things up a notch or two with Russia today, while President Trump says he still does want to have a good relationship with Vladimir Putin. This morning, the Treasury Department announced personal economic sanctions on 7 Russian billionaires who are close to Putin, oligarchs is the term, as well as 17 senior officials in the Russian government. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains who these people are and why they are being sanctioned.
The U.S. sanctions freeze assets held in the U.S., generally prohibit any business dealing with Americans, and bar transactions involving dollars. The seven oligarchs who are targeted are among the closest allies of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Some got their start in the chaotic post-Soviet Russia of the 1990s. Robert Legbold is a professor emeritus at Columbia University.
They were essentially stealing assets, often state assets, or they were rigged deals.
He's talking about people like Oleg Deripaska, who allegedly has ties to President Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort. The Treasury Department accuses Deripaska of money laundering and threatening the lives of business rivals. Then there's Kirill Shamalov, a Russian energy executive who married Putin's daughter 5 years ago. Anders Ostlund of the Atlantic Council says the sanctions are meant to isolate the Russian president. The message is Putin can't protect you.
To show Putin can't give you cover.
But it's not clear that the U.S. sanctions will stop what Treasury calls Russia's malign activities. Scheherazade Rahman of George Washington University says the people targeted by the sanctions aren't about to tell Putin to change his behavior. They're too afraid.
And they're justifiably afraid. You know, we've watched many oligarchs end up in prison for standing up and saying things that Putin was not happy to hear.
Rahman says the U.S. sanctions are a start, but they're not enough to spur real change. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
I know it feels like it was forever ago, but it's really only been about a month since tariffs started dominating economic news. And you might remember way back then, it was straight-up steel and aluminum tariffs we were talking about. When President Trump signed off on them, he said they would protect domestic steel producers and help American manufacturers. That first part does seem to be panning out. Some corners of the steel industry in this country are showing signs of life. But for manufacturing, it's more complicated. Marketplace's Erica Barris takes us to the Allegheny Mountains of Pennsylvania to see how it's playing out.
From the outside, Brookville Equipment Corporation looks like any other office building. But inside, the past meets the future. There are stripped-down streetcars from the 30s next to gleaming new ones. Workers assemble coal cars and locomotives. If it runs on a rail, Brookville probably makes it. And that takes steel. Tons of it. Ben Crana oversees those purchases and says,
there's been some pricing increases that have taken place in fourth quarter of 2017. And now that pricing is threatened to be perhaps even higher with the new steel tariffs.
And Brookville doesn't use cheaper imported steel. The company gets a lot of its business from cities that are given federal dollars. Dollars that need to be spent on products made in the U.S. with domestic materials, like steel. Crana says most of Brookville's manufacturing contracts are set years in advance.
We're not able to turn higher raw material prices or those costs, transfer those off to our end customer. Those have to be absorbed at Brookville to keep manufacturing.
Emily Blanchard, a business professor at Dartmouth University, says that will become the new normal for manufacturers.
All firms that use steel and don't get a break from foreign competition in what they're making, they'll be worse off.
Blanchard says manufacturers will be clamoring for domestic steel to avoid paying the tariff. Sellers have the upper hand now.
The same seller has two buyers instead of one, or 70 buyers instead of 20, they're going to be able to charge higher prices. And so that price is going to rise regardless of who they were selling to before.
Joel McNeil, vice president of business development for Brookville, says this company with its 300 employees has positioned itself to weather changes.
We're trying to be kind of spread out across different markets to compensate for an impact that we cannot manage ourselves.
Brookville has been around for a century. The company started off making locomotives, then equipment for the coal industry. As those markets tanked, Brookville moved into streetcars. It also makes rail cars for the steel industry. So if tariffs help the steel business grow, Brookville benefits too.
You can't put all your eggs in one basket. You need to be diversified.
Michael Moore, an economics professor at George Washington University, knows all about that. During college, he worked at a steel mill in Texas, and he was on the Council of Economic Advisors in 2002 when the Bush administration enacted steel tariffs. He's seen this scenario before.
You'll help some people, but you're likely to hurt a lot more in the process.
He says companies like Brookville that will have to pay more for steel but can't raise prices on their products will have to cut costs somewhere.
You might have to reduce your marketing costs, reduce the amount of labor costs through less overtime, reduce investment in future technological improvements.
The markets may even out eventually. Supply may meet the demand after years. But, says Moore,
it will be a real stressful time in the short term.
But the short term isn't a big preoccupation for Chris Lasher, an electrician who's been at Brookville for 23 years. He takes a break from wiring a vintage streetcar that'll soon be on the streets of El Paso, Texas, to give me his views.
I mean, obviously, as a American-made company, we'd like to see American-made steel.
Lasher says he's not too worried about the effect the tariffs will have on Brookville's future.
If we worried about that, we would probably not be in business today because we've seen the ups and downs.
And the company's still here. In Brookville, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Just as you count on Marketplace for reliable, in-depth news and information, we are counting on listeners like you to invest in what we do. The more people who support Marketplace, the more we can do to raise economic intelligence across this country. So before we do today's numbers, here is another number to think about. $5 a month. $5 a month, and you can become a Marketplace investor. The payoff? Knowing that you're helping thousands of people understand this economy, having conversations that matter, and making better financial decisions. Donate today at marketplace.org, and thanks. Coming up,
at first it'll cost $250,000. At first it'll be for the rich only.
After that, cheaper, we hope, the private space race. Straight ahead, but first, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. Yeah, you knew it was going to be the Wawas, right? The Dow at one point down about 750 points today. Closed off 2.3%, 572 on the downside, 23,932. NASDAQ threw off 2.2%, 161 points, 69.15. The S&P 500 reversed itself 2.1%, 58 points, 2604 there. Bad day, better week, really. Not great, but better. The Dow off 0.7%, the NASDAQ off 2.1%, S&P 500 down 1.4%. That lackluster jobs report gave big retailers the jitters. Nordstrom shares took a 4% markdown. Macy's unloaded 3.6% today. Kohl's forfeited more than 4% as well. Financials, Morgan Stanley sliced off more than 3%. Goldman Sachs dipped 2.2%. Bonds, steady yield on the 10-year, 2.77%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's corporate story comes to us from the nexus of cutting-edge consumer content and advertising. Reuters is reporting that Netflix wants to buy a billboard company. $300 million is what the new economy digital streaming company is said to be willing to spend on some old-school advertising. Nobody's confirming anything, of course. That's the way these things go. But Marketplace's Kimberly Adams spent some time today thinking about the billboard business and why a company like Netflix might want a piece of it.
Billboards have been the go-to choice for media companies for decades. And the company Netflix may be eyeing, Regency Outdoor Advertising, owns signs in iconic Southern California locations where advertising is expensive. Robert Miles is a senior analyst for IBIS World.
Billboards typically are a cost-effective way for entertainment companies to advertise, and it has the potential for Netflix to really control the increase in their advertising spending moving forward.
Potential. Netflix didn't respond to our request for comment, and Reuters says there are other offers. Erica Gruen, a media strategist and former television CEO, says $300 million is a lot for billboards. But she points out media companies don't necessarily advertise in Southern California to boost ratings.
It's not about influencing viewers. It's about influencing the creative community.
Like the people who vote for awards or a movie and television talent you may want to hire.
Using billboards to influence the creative community is a very common thing that people do in Hollywood. I mean, and it's kind of a vanity play, really.
That kind of vanity play may be worth it to a company like Netflix, says Matthew Thornton, an analyst at SunTrust Robinson Humphrey.
Maybe it's worthwhile, you know, taking that extra dollar and perhaps not putting it into new content, but bringing more attention to existing content.
Which you can do with a giant billboard on the Sunset Strip. I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The space race, as it used to be, really isn't anymore, right? The United States doesn't launch manned rockets anymore. The Russians do that for us. But that doesn't mean there isn't competition in the space economy. It's just being done in the private sector. Hello, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. Christian Davenport writes for The Washington Post. He's got a new book out about the billionaires trying to make space travel routine. It's called The Space Barons. Christian, good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, give me an update, would you? Where are we on plans for these two guys to get us, not just into space, really, but for Musk anyway, to Mars?
Well, the first next step for both these guys is to fly human beings. I mean, for all the triumphs and all the attention they've gotten, let's not forget that SpaceX has yet to fly a human being into space. And that first flight could come as early as this year, though maybe next year, of flying NASA's astronauts to the International Space Station. Jeff Bezos also wants to start flying human beings for space tourism flights. Those two could begin this year. And let's not forget Virgin Galactic, which also wants to fly tourists into space. And he's got 700 people or so signed up who are ready to do that.
Right. Virgin Galactic, of course, being Richard Branson, which we'll get to in a bit. Something you said there that is going to take me on a little detour from what I wanted to talk to you about. They're going to fly NASA's astronauts. So it's important to note here that these two guys, specifically Musk and Bezos, are concentrating on hardware. They're not doing the astronaut program thing.
What's happened is NASA retired the space shuttle in 2011. So the United States government and NASA has not had the ability to fly astronauts from U.S. soil since then. We pay the Russians to do it. So what NASA started to do was they said, you know what, we're going to contract this out. We're going to outsource this service of flying astronauts to the International Space Station. They've hired SpaceX and Boeing have the contracts to do that. And the idea is that by contracting that out to the private sector, NASA then can focus on deeper space. Trump has talked very specifically about wanting to partner with these companies in order to go back to the moon.
So let's talk about these two guys, because they are, you know, the book is about these two guys, Musk and Bezos, but also Richard Branson and Paul Allen of Microsoft fame. Let's talk about these two guys. They could not really be more opposite, could they?
That's right. Elon is brilliant at marketing and PR and gets all sorts of attention and is just brash. I mean, you saw the pictures of the Tesla flying around in space with the mannequin inside.
Some would call that savvy, man. Some would call that, you know, right?
Or a stunt, right? Yeah, but it got a lot of attention. And while he's been sort of the brash hare, you've got Jeff Bezos. And so many people don't even realize that Jeff has a space company. People don't know Blue Origin, and that's largely by design. But now we're at a really critical moment where they're starting to come out of the shadows a little bit. And so the two of them could be in competition.
We should say here that Jeff Bezos owns, and I'm obliged to add here, in a personal capacity, the paper for which you work, The Washington Post. You call him Jeff. I would call him Mr. Bezos, but that's a whole nother deal. I think think it's interesting the approaches the two of them are taking, right? Bezos is all like mythical, right? The new Glenn, the new John Glenn rocket. And he's got a motto for his company. And as far as you can tell from SpaceX and Elon Musk, it's, get to space and break things and do it fast and get a lot of press, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the different approaches that they've taken. You know, Elon was out there getting attention, trying to break into the market, and he had to break things, you know, not just like testing rockets, but suing people. I mean, and he waged a huge lobbying campaign in Washington for the rights to be able to compete for some of these contracts and ultimately won. And because SpaceX has paved the way, you could see Blue Origin sort of following in that track and being able to do that.
A word here about tourism in space, Richard Branson and Virgin Galactic and Spaceship One and Paul Allen. It's still very much a rich person's bailiwick, right? I mean, the first person to go to space is not going to spend $29.99 for a commuter ticket.
No, they're paying $250,000 a ticket, and that's what it costs. And we don't know what Blue Origin is going to charge its customers to go to space. They haven't announced that yet, whether there'll be any deal with Amazon Prime.
the best $99 a year I ever spent, man.
But knowing how they operate, you know, you would think they would come in and, totally. And undercut the market. The idea is, though, that at first it'll cost $250,000. At first it'll be for the rich only. Then if they're able to do it safely and reliably and they can prove that this is a real viable industry and nobody gets killed, then the idea is that the cost would come down.
Right.
Another part of it is that once you can get to space affordably and reliably, that could open up all sorts of business activity in space, from small satellites, manufacturing in space. And they see this as a precursor to being able to do that.
Christian Davenport writes for The Washington Post. His most recent book is called The Space Barons, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the Quest to Colonize the Cosmos. Christian, thanks a lot for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, anecdotal to be sure, but perhaps a way to start thinking about the congressional hearings that Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg is going to be headlining next week. We were sitting in a meeting this morning thinking about how to add to our coverage of that whole Cambridge Analytica Facebook story when I had a thought. So I pulled out my computer, typed out a quick Twitter poll, and asked people whether they would pay for Facebook. With all appropriate disclaimers stipulated, and yes, I appreciate the irony of this being a Twitter poll about Facebook, but anyway, I still think the results are interesting. 3,316 votes so far. It breaks down like this. 86% of people said no, they would not pay for Facebook, thank you very much. 14% said yes. Lots of good responses. You can see them in my Twitter feed. I'm at Kai Rizdal, KAIRYSSDAL, because some people complained the other day when I didn't spell it. All right, we got to go late of a Friday afternoon. The Dow Industrials sheared off 2.3% today, about 572 points. NASDAQ down 2.2%, 161. The S&P 500 off 2.1%, 58 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We are back on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.